We'll jump right in with Austin Curry, who I'm sure everyone knows Austin as civil rights campaigner, MP, founding member of the SGLP, Minister for Housing, Local Government Planning, in the Northern Ireland Executive, during the strike, during signing down, and then after that, Chuck Adala, candidate for vice president, so on and so forth. And so, Austin?
What, you're calling me now, are you?
Yes.
And how long have we got?
About 20 minutes.
We'll not take that time. I find the most useful part of discussions like this is when people like me sit down and we start talking to each other. So let's hope I can do that. I'm the audience, some I recognise, older, mind you, than the last time that I met them. On occasions like this, I'm reminded of what Bernard the Devlin said at a debate she and I were having in Liberty Hall in Dublin. A very heated discussion, and eventually she turned around and said, "I am confident in the knowledge that I will have the last word, and my version is the one that will survive." She said, "Because I was the youngest of them, and I'm likely to outlive the rest of you." So, I was the youngest of a lot of crowds, and I'm still surviving. This is centred on the strike, or as those of us who had strong feelings on the subject used to call it, the putsch. But it has to be seen against the background of the election in February of that year. The election was held on the 20th of February, when the executive had only come into operation just over 6 weeks, when we had not an opportunity to prove our worth, when we had no chance to erode the suspicions and prejudices that had arisen, and where the United Unions grouping got 50.8% of the electorate in their favour, and where they could obviously say that they had the support of the electorate of Northern Ireland, and the electorate of Northern Ireland was against the agreement. Now, we could argue about that, because there had been certain constituencies where there had been split votes and that sort of thing, but the fact was they still got over 50% of the electorate in their favour. And it was a very serious blow to Brian Faulkner, who already was facing enough difficulties inside the union's community and inside his own party. He had failed to get his own party to support the power sharing arrangement, and now the electorate appeared to be giving the thumbs down to it as well. So from the very beginning, Faulkner was in trouble. And then, of course, there was that signpost which was so influential, which said, "Sunningdale, Dublin is only a Sunningdale away." Whoever thought of that one deserves a lot of credit in the unionist loyalist community, because it centred on what was the central argument that was put forward by loyalists, which related to the Council of Ireland and not to the Sunningdale Agreement as a whole. And it was very important in focusing that argument. My belief then and my belief now is that that slogan and the emphasis on the Council of Ireland helped to mask an even wider reason for opposition to to the Sunningdale Agreement, and that was opposition to power sharing. That there were those who said their opposition was to the Council of Ireland, but effectively their opposition was to power sharing. The very idea, and I put it brutally and bluntly, the very idea of Catholics being involved at the highest level in government in Northern Ireland was anathema to those people. And even though the Council of Ireland, even if the Council of Ireland hadn't been there, the involvement of Catholics, nationalists, at the highest level of government would have been enough to have aroused their opposition. There were other factors. I'm sorry I wasn't in for the earlier discussion. I missed most of it. Towards the end, there was some discussion of the role of the British government and the culpability of the British government for the successful strike that occurred. And there's no doubt that the Wilson government didn't have the same commitment to Sunningdale as those who were responsible for it. And I'm thinking of Ted Heath in particular. I might have had my disagreements with Heath on social and economic grounds, but there was no doubting his commitment to the agreement that he and Whitelaw were largely responsible for bringing about. The Labour government didn't have the same commitment. It wasn't there. Agreement. It was the agreement that had been brought about by the political opposition. I never had much time for Harold Wilson. We'd had quite a few dealings with him in opposition as well as in government. I never trusted him. He was the type when you were involved in discussions with him, and particularly if you had a meal with him afterwards. I remember sitting beside him, and he claimed credit for everything he thought I agreed with and blamed Jim Callaghan for everything that he knew I disagreed with. So he was not to be trusted. I remembered he came to Dublin, and he had an arrangement with John O'Connell, and in John O'Connell's house he met the leadership of the Provisional IRA, and he came out with 15 points, which meant nothing at the time. And so I was suspicious of him on that particular level as well. So I didn't, as I say, have much faith in him. Merlin Rees I had more faith in, because in opposition Merlin Rees had been assiduous as the Labour Party spokesman in relation to Northern Ireland. He spent a lot of time in Northern Ireland. He did a lot of work. He knew his facts. And he seemed to be sympathetic to the SDLP. He certainly was sympathetic to the SDLP. At the same time, he was conscious of the unionist arguments. The trouble about Merlin, as we found out afterwards, was that he had difficulty making up his mind. I think Paddy Devlin, as in so many respects, I think Paddy got it right when he said that Merlin was always struggling with his conscience. The trouble was, it always ended in a draw. And, we found in our dealings with Merlin that was a very sort of apt remark. The other factor, I don't know whether it was alluded to this morning or not, the other strong factor was the attitude of the British Army. The British Army eventually, I think, was the decisive factor in the attitude of the British government. Lisburn felt very strongly, and probably certainly at a London level as well, felt very strongly that they should not be waging a war on two fronts. They felt they had enough on their hands in dealing with the Proudhons without having to deal with the Loyalists as well. And I think this came over very strongly at crucial times, and particularly during the strike. I don't know whether Glenibar was quoted this morning or not. I have quoted him in the past. I made reference to him in my book. The fact that I never got any negative reaction meant either that he didn't read the book or disagreed or agreed with my quotation, but I believe that at an early stage, he said that if the strike had been tackled at an early stage, then it would have collapsed. I think that is quoting him correctly, and I think what he said was true. That was my belief, that if the effective action had been taken in the first couple of days, then the strike would have ended. If action had been taken to stop intimidation, if action had been taken to allow those people who wish to work to go to work, then those civil servants, for example, in my department, whom I knew wanted to work, who couldn't get out of their housing estates, or who were afraid of the effect on their families if they came out of their housing estates and were seen to go to work. I believe if the army and the police had acted effectively in the first few days, then the strike would have petered out, rightly or wrongly. The other factor, of course, is that the executive had two enemies. Sunningdale had two enemies. The emphasis is put on the Loyalist strike. People forget, or nowadays don't wish us to remember, the effect that the Proudhon campaign had on bringing down the Sunningdale Agreement. Brian Faulkner believed that Sunningdale would contribute enormously to a Freyas that wasn't in existence at the time it sat in South Africa, but became very popular afterwards, the peace process. He believed that as a result of Sunningdale, that violence would certainly be diminished. The opposite happened. If I remember correctly, between the beginning of January and the end of April, when the strike started in May, something like 84 people lost their lives. There were some horrible atrocities occurred in that period. They were not just Loyalist atrocities, like the killing of my very good friends and neighbours, Jim and Gertie Devlin, but you had the Proudhon atrocities and an escalation of their violence into places where there had been little violence in the past. For example, to Larne and to Bangor. The result is that Brian Faulkner was left in an extremely weak position. People would say to him, you promised us that this agreement, this sellout, would bring about peace. It hasn't. It's worse than it ever was. There's an escalation of it. And so Faulkner was left in an extremely vulnerable position. Those appear to be the main sort of general factors that I would want to speak about. I hope I've said sufficient to give you some reason to ask me questions or to make a contribution. And I'll do my best and look forward to responding to what you have to say and what my fellow panelists have to say. So that'll do me, just for the moment.
Thank you so much. Next we have Tom McKierney, who comes from a provincial Republican background, at least in this time period, famously on hunger strike in 1980. Since then, he's gone on to do work with the Independent Workers Union of Ireland. His book, The Provisional IRA, From Insurrection to Parliament, which was published in 2011, is one example of the number of contributions Tommy has made to problematizing the kind of provisional narrative as it stands today. So, Tommy?
Okay, thank you. And I find it a little bit strange to have to follow on from a man who I think used to be my MP under the old Stormont regime. And I suppose from the outset, what I can say is that with the collapse of the Sunningdale arrangement, that the Provisional IRA welcomed its collapse probably just as much as did the unionist community, and for a number of reasons. The assessment made at the time by the Provisional IRA was multifaceted. On one hand, there was the assessment that it was unlikely to survive. It was unlikely to exist. The facts were borne out by what happened during the strike. It has to be said that there was no appetite through the majority of the unionist population for a power-sharing government. On the other hand, the Provisional IRA, as the strike was beginning, had a number of reasons for assessing the power-sharing executive, the Sunningdale Agreement as it stood at the time. And I think we have to keep in mind the outlook of a sizeable section of the community within Northern Ireland and beyond. And while, and I, over the course of the years, have come to understand that there are many explanations and understandings of the reasons and the personality and the performance of people at the time, but I think it can sometimes be underestimated the opinion in which Brian Faulkner, for example, was held by a vast number of people within the Republican and Nationalist community. Brian Faulkner had been one of the pillars of the old unionist regime. He was seen as the author of internment. Very, very well remembered for being the Prime Minister of Northern Ireland who pronounced the introduction of internment. One of those episodes, seminal episodes in the history of this region, which by anybody's calculation, and I think it was the man on my left who actually described one time internment as being a recruiting sergeant for the Provisional IRA, if I haven't misquoted you, Austin.
No, you haven't.
And, well, thank you for that confirmation. So therefore we had, at that stage, we had Brian Faulkner back again as the leader of an administration in Northern Ireland, and on this occasion supported by the SDLP. Now it has to be said that in light of all that, there was a very considerable antagonism within the Nationalist Republican community, and this antagonism was undoubtedly reflected within the Provisional IRA. And their assessment therefore would be, could this work and would it work to promote a progressive settlement? Would it and could it? And again, the belief that it wouldn't. Now, in that light, and let's keep in mind, we're not necessarily talking here in terms of moral philosophy. We're talking here about practical assessments of what was happening and what was likely to happen. So therefore, the decision was quite obvious that this settlement was neither sustainable or in many ways desirable, nor would it work. So therefore, there was going to be a continuation of opposition to this arrangement, and so it persisted. But what has to be also kept in mind is that by anybody's yardstick, it was not the Provisional IRA that brought down the Sunningdale Agreement. It was the combined efforts of the Ulster Workers' Council strike, supported largely by the unionist population. Now, we've heard the figures of 50 plus 8. We've heard of the election of 11 out of 12 MPs in the February election of 74. So it's quite obvious that it wasn't just a handful of malcontents in the Ulster Workers' Council strike who decided to disrupt and bring down Sunningdale. Sunningdale run into serious, practical opposition, both in terms of physical resistance and political resistance, from within the unionist community of Northern Ireland. So therefore, the idea that, for a start, that the Provisional IRA had the capacity or the power to bring down Sunningdale is a mistake. The response from the Provisional IRA also looked not just at the situation in its entirety, but they looked at specific elements of it. One, there was the question of the SDLP, and there has been long a historic division within the broadest Republican or nationalist constituency between, if you like, it's not just physical force versus constitutional, but it also is the revolutionary transformation of that society as opposed to reform. And it was viewed that the SDLP was involved in what was going to be inevitably an internal settlement within Northern Ireland, in spite of what was spoken of the Council of Ireland. The SDLP was and remains very much a six-county party. It didn't have a remit beyond Northern Ireland. We've heard it said that there wasn't even a good or working relationship between Gerry Fitt, the leader of the SDLP, and some elements of the Dublin government. Now, these differences can be smoothed over, obviously, but a six-county party it was, a six-county party it has remained. It was unlikely that that was going to transform the situation. So, when Sunningdale was brought down, the response from within the IRA was, it has won, it has undermined, as it undoubtedly did, the position of the SDLP. The SDLP's proposals, its confidence, its enthusiasm had proven to be misplaced and mistaken. And the provisionals, the IRA, were able to reflect on the performance of the SDLP while in government. They had sat down while internment had still remained, while prisoners were still in prison, while the security apparatus had effectively remained unchanged. The SDLP was sitting with Brian Faulkner, and the SDLP was implementing aspects of the state in a way that was very reminiscent of former elements of the state, where the SDLP was quite happy to invoke punitive measures within the state in terms of its response, and bear in mind its response, and possibly unjustly, I would say, being aware of some of the incidents, blame laid at some of the members of the SDLP for certain incidents, but certainly they were able to invoke the coercive elements of the state to support their position. On the other hand, the response from within the IRA, in terms of unionism, it was able to see and portray unionism as being intractable and obdurate. Keep in mind, the Sunningdale Agreement was an agreement that had effectively been brokered by a Conservative government in Britain. And while I have an understanding, and I think perhaps it's an avenue that has been underexplored, is how we may resolve this problem of ours, the constitutional problem within the six counties, on our own. But the point remains that for so long as you have a United Kingdom, you may not talk in terms of a majority position in Northern Ireland, because Northern Ireland is an integral part of the United Kingdom. And if the British government's wishes and desires can be overturned by a small region, if the British government doesn't enforce its mandate and its writ within the United Kingdom, you have to call into question the British government's enthusiasm and its determination to see what it said was the best possible settlement. Which brings us across then to the IRA's response again to the British government. The British government had organised, had promoted, had brokered the Sunningdale Agreement, and then, when it was challenged, stepped well back from it. The British Army effectively sat on its hands throughout that period. The British Army took a position that it would observe, I think was the phrase, observe rather than intervene. Now, in terms of a governmental mandate, the writ of the state not running, if it doesn't run in Northern Ireland, well, if the governmental writ doesn't run, whose writ will run? And that's the question then. If you're not bound by central government, well, then does it become a free-for-all? And effectively, it very well may do so. The British government, on the other hand, and again, I'm not in possession of any proof, but let's be realistic about it, that one of the largest atrocities of the conflict, largest in terms of death, was the Dublin and Monaghan bombings. Now, it may be that the civil servants in Stormont, and I'm not being noxious about this, but it may in the Strum und Drang that was pertaining at the time have been something that was on the periphery, but for an all-Ireland organisation such as the Provisionals, the bombing of Monaghan and Dublin was something that was not on the periphery. And keep in mind that from the outset it was deemed that British intelligence had questions to answer for the Dublin and Monaghan bombing, and that is an issue that hasn't gone away to this very day. We're aware that within the last week or 10 days there has been requests made for additional information. Now, whether that stands up or doesn't stand up, it's a perception that's well held. So therefore, overall, the assessment could be made from a Republican point of view that on one hand, the outcome of the Workers' Council strike had created a number of issues. One, it had, if you like, disadvantaged the SDLP enormously. And that was something that the Provisional IRA, making their assessment, was certainly not disappointed with. It had shown unionism to be obdurate. In many ways, this allowed an IRA campaign to continue on the basis that if this type of settlement can't be brokered, therefore this situation will continue. Because if you can't resolve a situation diplomatically, politically, constitutionally, what other way will it be resolved? And moreover, the sovereign government, the central state, had been shown to be weak to the point of vacillation, quite possibly indifferent to maintaining its own writ in that area, and allowing the interpretations to be drawn that the central government was willing to be downfaced by unionism while it was quite prepared and had demonstrated its willingness to use lethal, ruthless force against nationalists and republicans. And therefore, and as I say, we're not necessarily here talking moral philosophy. This is not a seminary. We're looking, unfortunately, at the realpolitik of Northern Ireland of 40 years ago. And as a result of that, we were doomed to continue. The thing about it is this, and this is one of the phrases that I take great exception to, is Sunningdale for slow learners. If there was any slow learners at Sunningdale, it was the people who coined that phrase. Because if unionism wasn't willing to do the deal, and if the British government wasn't willing to enforce it, the slow learners were those who thought that it might work.
Can
Right, thanks. And now our third speaker is Harry Donaghy, who at the time was an activist in official Republican circles from Lower Falls, and is now involved in cross-community peace building around the shared history of the First World War. He once expressed the opinion that the Sunningdale executive was the greatest lost opportunity of all in Tony Novosel's recent book on loyalism. So, Harry?
Thank you very much. Again, I came to today's talk from the brief that Connell had given me about my memories of the time back in May 1974. Memory can be not the most reliable a basis for speaking on the factualities of history, but I'll do my best in that regard. In May 1974, I was 16 years of age. My schooling education had been somewhat interrupted at the outbreak of the Troubles. I had basically given up on any form, recognisable form of study, and proceeded into the job market. My first job was as a commis chef in the Royal Avenue Hotel in the centre of Belfast. Growing up, at that time, I was a member of one of the armed groups who had some years previously came up with a critique, an analysis that for all the inequities of the Stormont government and its decades of rule in the country, the descent, seemingly unstoppable descent into all-out sectarian war, says was a thing to be stood up and argued against. I remember I was not, unlike some of the speakers here today, physically involved in the macro politics of the time, either in government civil service circles or as part of the parties involved in what became known at the time and later as the Sunningdale Agreement. We do have to look back, hopefully, with a degree of understanding and compassion as to what people were feeling at the time. It was raw. It was emotional. It wasn't really a good time for any type of society, certainly not our own. And again, the time and what came after, it is difficult sometimes to be objective in that regard. But certainly, I think it is and can be argued that for maybe the first time, certainly since partition, since 1920, when the island was divided, that in the northern part of the island, whatever enthusiasm there was from the leadership of British unionism or Irish nationalism, that it was an opportunity to begin some kind of dialogue or process where the two nationalisms, three generations after partition, had found themselves basically in a kind of Groundhog Day situation. But the questions that faced them says, will the opportunities for compromise be grasped or worked on? Or will we return to the default position of sectarian slaughter? I do believe that attempts were made to at least approach that critical issue in the politics of this part of the island with a degree of honesty that people were able to use at the time. Like always in our situation, positions of staunchness were adopted on all sides. I remember talking to some old school friends who were then active members of the Provisional IRA, and they sincerely believed that the posters that were put up from Divis Street to Twinbrook, that 73 would be the year of victory, that the war, the struggle, he says, it forced the British to engage in a process where they would issue a statement or intent to withdraw. Others saw that for what it was, it was somehow unreal. The riposte to that position at the time from leaders within official republicanism is that armed republicanism stood not on the brink of victory but on the brink of sectarian disaster. That what was needed in camera and in the macro elements of politics, that people talk to one another. Some in the audience may be here today. Unfortunately, many of those who took part in intergroup, interorganizational talks at the time, way away from anything to do with the media or newspapers, but it did. Messages were sent back and forward, both on the outside and, more importantly, probably at the end up, and certainly in the preceding decades, was what the prisoners were talking about in the jails, whether they be in loyalist compounds or wings or Republican. It wasn't. There's a tendency sometimes to look as time and distance separates us from physical events, that we can't fall into the trap of making them comfortable or making them as nice as possible. But it wasn't, certainly not in Belfast, certainly not in the other urban conurbations, and certainly not in the countryside, which was never distant, separate or remote from the upsurge, certainly, and out and out sectarian murder, and let's call it for what it was. That was it. If Sunningdale or the people, either at the British and Irish government level of things, here, the representatives of the political parties, the civil service, whatever it says, again, maybe looking back on the thing, it says what happened in the next 10 years or the next 20 years or 25 years or 30 years or 40 years, that when finally, through various circumstances, Sunningdale was 74, maybe was a point or two, he says, and it was a long and bloody road to the agreement of April 1998. Again, establishments like Queen's University or Jordanstown, colleges and things, and debating societies, the arguments will continue about the who, where, why, what, and when. Where have we arrived at today, looking back on the strike of 40 years ago, unionism, loyalism's position then, loyalists and unionism's position in the preceding decades, where we've arrived at today, And maybe more importantly, he says, then where do we go from here? It's not the best of places, certainly. And again, we can't continually say that because the undertakers aren't working overtime as they used to in the past, that this is, are the expectations that we limit ourselves to. We have to. We've proved in the past that especially those who were members or participated in the violence, in the death and mayhem that took place, but slowly but surely came to the realization through various journeys, whether they be from the groups and organizations involved or those very important personal journeys, that we have, whether we like it or not, arrived at where we're at today. And maybe the conversations that are still very necessary about the future, whatever we would like it to be, however many adjectives we use to describe something that we would like to see, I think the template has already been set in that regard, that we must continue to talk. We must continue to talk honestly and openly with one another. And we're back to that old conundrum that Irish and British nationalisms, as they're defined or accepted or embraced today, we have to make sure at least that it's not the Irish nationalism of our grandfathers or the British nationalism of our grandfathers that we perpetually play out with one another. It's not to say that the two identities, the two allegiances, the legitimacy of the two nationalisms should somehow be thrown away or abandoned by anyone. But the outdated and delinquent forms, certainly the methodologies we have used in the past to show those who are not of us who and what we are, at least we should have the moral courage, he says, to advance work that was done back then in the preceding decades. As you refer to, Glenny, today, your vision of bringing not just politicians and the great and the good, it says, well, but bringing people from our backgrounds to a small nondescript village in western Flanders where former enemies could have the space and maybe more importantly the time, says, to engage in these types of conversations about what led us to what we did at points in history, but we're here for good and ill in the modern day. Now, what role do we play, or still have to play, says, in encouraging the organisations, the communities, the people around us, says, that that the default position should never be arrived at again, that future discussions about the future of this society, this country and the people in it, says, have to be conducted in that manner. And it will call for a degree of compassion and more space for tolerance, which we seem to have been losing this past while back, especially from peace was declared back in 1998. We have to continue on in those journeys, whether they're personal, whether they're group or organisational. We still have to keep those lights in the window, because we risk at the moment, I believe, he says, of losing a sizeable maybe percentage of a generation who have no physical experience of the decades that we've been talking about. Now, why would we not stand up and say that, that if that's What do you feel? That you miss something, or to prove your loyalism, or unionism, or republicanism, or nationalism, that the first thing you reach for is a revolver. Says we all can, in tiny, incremental ways, bring arguments to bear on that. And we have to be not just in a conversational sense, we have to prove to one another that when we go from here onwards, maybe, again, the decade of centenaries has pluses and minuses in it, but surely there is space now created where we can look at what our grandfathers or great-grandfathers did 100 years ago at the turn of the 20th century, and all of the intervening decades, and it applies to Republicans, says, as much as it does to Unionists or Loyalists, says, if we are to create, work towards a society that can truly tolerate within it, says, Irish and British identities, then the form, shape and content of whatever state or political construct that comes out of the decades to come, at least we can say with some degree of honesty and sincerity that when given the opportunity, we stepped up to the plate. If it's a footnote, a tiny footnote in history, I would certainly rather be remembered for advocating that as to actions in the past that had violence at their centre. And again, the ways and forms that will take, again, the importance of journeys, the creating the space for tolerance, genuine tolerance about the future of British identities in the modern context, in the modern historical context that we find ourselves in today. I think it would be a criminal waste if we didn't all, in our own way, step up and at least play a part in that. That maybe 40 years from now, our grandchildren will turn around and say, well, at least they tried, at least they tried, and feel no compunction, no obligation in the future when discussing their identity or their national allegiance to reach for weapons anymore. Thank you very much.